Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine and the Army's vision of warfare. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, your host for today's episode. I am joined by Brigadier General Clinton Murray, Commanding General of the United States Army Medical Center of Excellence, or MEDCO. General Murray has served as a physician and leader in organizations around the globe. Today, we will discuss the critical topics of triage, casualty evacuation, and disease and non-battle injury in the context of large-scale combat operations. Sir, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
We talk about FM3O a lot on this podcast. So before we dive into those three big topics, I'd like to talk about the operational environment, the OE. And I was wondering if you could highlight some of those aspects of the OE that listeners might not have considered, you know, if they're a tactical leader, combat arms leader, and they haven't thought about medical.
Yeah, I think what we've seen in multi-domain operations and large-scale combat operations for the non-medical folks continued to apply within the medical space, the concept of the, you know, the character of war changing. I think we've also seen in the character of medicine. Character of medicine slowly changing, it's being more digitally related, it's more virtual related, and I think we'll continue to see a little bit more of that as we move forward in the clinical environment, but also the operational clinical environment where we're taking care of casualties downrange. But the character of war that's changing with drones and the information space, I think we've seen the same thing changing within medicine, right? So if you look at the Gaza war, how hospitals and patients were all part of the narrative in that story, mm-hmm. and how important it is. And I think when you look at global health engagement, and especially the Indo-PACOM, but you can argue all the COCOMs have that, it really is sort of setting us up sort of the pre-crisis, pre-competition space by being able to work with our partners, be able to tell that good news story. So that information space can be used both ways. And I think it's the same thing with the multi-domain operations with drones. What we've seen with drones and their ability to see patients, to see casualties is beneficial, right? We can see folks out on the battlefield, be able to identify them and pull them back. The flip side of that is also true, that you can see the medical assets, you can see the casualties mm-hmm. on the battlefield, and if you decide to target them, we're also very visible and very vulnerable in that environment. And then I think the broader operational environment that the medical has in LISCO sort of stays the same. The disease problems we've seen around the world are impacted a little bit by the climate changes, and we'll see what that really looks like over the next 20 years. But I think disease threats will remain true. I think battle injuries will remain true. I think the non-battle injuries, you know, hurting your back, picking up something too heavy will remain true. I think the toxin exposures will probably remain true. I think some things we are looking at that are a little bit differently. Genetic manipulation is being increasingly used around the world. We can actually do that through an FDA approval process for sickle cell anemia. You can imagine what else that can be used for good, and what actually that could be used for not good. So it will be pretty interesting to sort of see how this will really work out over the next 20 years. But I think lots that we're seeing in the Ukraine, lots that we're seeing in Indo-PACOM and other COCOMs, we're going to continue to see medically and sort of the non-medical perspective.
Okay. I think you kind of maybe hinted at this with when you mentioned Israel-Gaza, but in the medical community, are you thinking about dispersion, masking? Because you're protected under the Geneva Conventions, but we know that the enemy is not always going to abide by those. So how are you thinking through that from your lens?
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting perspective. If you look at what we've seen in the Ukraine-Russia war, there's actually a World Health Organization or WHO organization that tracks the number of medical entities, personnel, vehicles that are actually injured or destroyed. And that number is pretty impressive in the Ukraine war. So the purposeful target of medical assets is probably something we really have to be thinking about in that COCOM. I think when you look at other COCOMs and their reliance on the Geneva Convention and their sort of approach to the Geneva Convention, like the Indo-PACOM, I think it's going to be much more upheld. So I think we have to be very careful to applying too many lessons we may see in the Ukraine into the China space. That being stated, it absolutely is changing the way we're thinking. If you watch how the Ukraine's moved their casualties, they're able to move from point of injury to role one for about 4 to 8 hours. We used to do that in 15 to 40 minutes in Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. They can't move to role two, which could be either sort of enhanced care or even with surgical care for about 24 hours. So now you have to think about how long you're holding patients and what you're doing from that space. But then if you try to disperse too much, you don't have the right personnel, the right equipment, the right supplies far forward or in role one and role two. And if you make yourself too protected, then you're sort of non-mobile. And the problem with mobility and patient care is once you're in an ICU, you really can't easily move someone in an ICU. Once you start a surgery, you can't really move someone once that surgery is started. So we have some finite windows of time that once you get in that window, you can't move. So it's a complete balance of this sort of perspective of how do you be mobile, how do you be protected, all at the exact same time. Almost impossible to do. We'll see how this really works out. But a lot of effort is going into both of those areas, because I do think no matter how you look at it in the Ukraine, if they're purposefully targeting medical assets, that's an issue. But if you go to Indo-PACOM and talk about the island chain hopping of 800 kilometers between islands, that's a long distance. So even if you have the lack of targeting of medical assets, the tyranny of moving patients is still a problem set. Mm-hmm. You're still going to have problems approached differently based upon facilities, equipment, supplies, expertise, and the such.
You said role one and role two. Can we lay that out for our listeners? Because I know we're going to talk those terms.
Yeah.
In the podcast.
So we typically talk about layers of care over a continuum. So you have your initial point of injury or point of need, whether that's disease, non-battle injury, or battle injury. And that's really that acute life-saving intervention. Then they typically move from point of injury to role one. Role one is very limited medical assets, maybe a physician assistant, some medics, a physician. And their job is just to stabilize, right? And then you get moved again, another evacuation process to role two. Role two is where you have lab and you have x-rays and you have some cots. You don't really have inpatient beds. And then you can augment role two in the Army with surgical assets, a forward resuscitative surgical detachment. And then you move again to role three, and that's where you really get into hospitalization. That's where you have ICUs. That's where you have real ward beds, where you have nurses monitoring you, where you have full-up pharmacies, you have CT scans, you have full-up x-rays, you have blood product support, a little differently than role two. And then you move again to role four, which is sort of a brick and mortar. Typically, role four can be considered back in the States. Or if you're in Germany, it's Larnstuhl Regional Medical Center, or it's Brian D. Allgood Community Hospital in Korea. So a little bit of difference in that role four. But it's really that continuum of need and care that we talk about across roles.
Okay. So I'd like to dive first into our first of the three topics today. It's triage, so okay. Probably a good lead-in with talking about the roles of care. So the current definition of triage in FM4-02 is the process of sorting casualties based on need for treatment, evacuation, and available resources. So I'm curious if that definition adequately addresses how the Army Health System is going to provide support in LISCO.
Yeah, I think that definition is very accurate for what we've seen for the last 20 years of sort of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, where we could rapidly move patients from point of injury to really surgical care, blood product support, everything you really sort of needed. As you are not in such a permissive environment where you have air superiority, you have all the supplies you need, you have control of the roads. So when you start to lose that and you start to have large numbers of casualties, then you have to sort of think about triage almost all the time. We almost didn't have to think about it during Iraq and Afghanistan wars. So as such, you have to sort of look at that definition. If you go into the Joint Publication 402 or the Extremity War Surgery, it enhances that definition a little bit. So it talks about medical urgency. It talks about mission. It talks about supplies. It talks about the tactical environment. So that enables you as the provider, you as the medical team, the Army Health System, and the sort of the operational line environment to be able to balance almost those four terms of what's the tactical environment, what's the medical urgency, what's the mission, and then what's the supplies that you need, and then be able to have an honest conversation at the individual patient level about triage and at the collective level. So we are rewriting 402 to broaden it out a little bit, to look or the Army Health System triage out a little bit, so it looks a little bit more like the joint publication, and probably more applicable for what large-scale combat operations and multi-domain operations will look like.
So am I getting this correct? It's not, we maybe, the current definition is more like one size fits all, and then we're moving to something that's MET-TCI.
Yeah, I think when you look at the first one, it's sort of limited. It almost focused more on the patient side of this conversation, where I think the new definition broadens it out and includes a little bit more of the mission, and allows you to also look at medical urgency in the tactical situation. You know, we've always talked about tactical combat casualty care, or TCCC, is layers. And the first TCCC is return fire when you're getting shot at. It's not actually go out, save that person, pull them off the battlefield, because the chance of you getting shot as the medic running out actually is probably not ideal, because then you're not treating the next patient, the next patient, the next patient. So we've always layered it. I think we're just being more deliberate in our definition of, hey, these are the things to consider when you're talking about triage.
Okay. So I don't know if I'm being nuanced here. Does changing that definition change the approach to triage as we focus more on LISCO?
I don't think it changes the approach, but it probably changes your mental thought of triage, because now you do have to think about the mission and you do have to think about the tactical situation deliberately, versus before, especially in the last 20 years, those aren't the thoughts that need to be paramount in your mind. In large-scale combat operations, when you're going to have 1,200 patients, now even if the mission is okay and the tactical situation is stable, we're not going to have the number of people or the number of hospital beds or the ORs or surgeons or surgical teams or supplies to be able to manage 1,200 patients in a Rule 2 facility. So because of that, that approach to triage is just going to have to be much more deliberate. So as you move from the mission being sort of in an environment you can get the yes, now the medical urgency says you can't treat everyone, because medically you can't treat everyone, mm-hmm. Versus the tactical situation is now stable. So it just broadens it out a little bit.
So I'm thinking, you know, my experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan, one person gets injured, you're calling up a 9 line right away, and you're going to get helicopter support most likely. What can that tactical commander, that platoon leader, what should they be thinking about when it's tens of people injured? Like how do they change that thought process?
I think that's really important. So during Iraq and Afghanistan, about 1.5 patients were on every medevac bird, right? There's 6 places for litter patients, you know, 12-ish for ambulatory. We didn't need all those beds. So now there's this concept of how do you appreciate the complexity we're now in with that number of casualties. So the line that soldier at the front has to understand, A, continue taking care of the tactical situation, continue to take care of the mission, but now you're going to have casualties, your friends, that are going to be next to you, and what do you do with those? So how does combat life support training across everyone become more important? How does the conversation about CASAVAC become important for everyone? And it has to be part of that new normal. Because as you said, if you were shot, almost the mission stopped and you took care of the casualty. Mm-hmm. The ground convoy stopped if you took casualties and you called in a medevac. You're probably not stopping that ground convoy. You're probably not stopping that mission. You may, you know, pause someone, get them into a safe space and continue on the mission. But I think that mentality is going to have to be new and different. And it's going to take a lot of effort. Now, the good thing is, good thing is not probably the right word. I think we're going to have an entire generation of soldiers that have not been in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, that's right? True. I'm old.
Yeah. So if we teach them now what 5, 10, 15, 20 casualties around you means, they don't have the mindset of you bring in a medevac, there's a combat medic there immediately. You are now responsible for it while that medic comes up, while that medevac becomes part of that place.
I haven't been to a CTC in a couple of years now. So have you been able to visit, and are they simulating that or teaching that? Or?
They're still struggling with that, right? I still think the CTCs are classically designed for the warfighters, right? They're the ones that are really trying to get to that mission set. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen is if you really turn on large-scale combat operations and the casualty numbers, it almost stops the warfighter from being able to practice that CTC requirements, because the prolonged stopping of mission, the inability to resupply, the inability to reconstitute those soldiers that are now evacuated out would probably stop the mission from going forward. Now, you can easily make the argument, shouldn't we do that? So you know that's reality. And I think we should do that. You know, if the normal CTC is 7 days, make the last day sort of a real fight where you really are going to manage the casualties. You really are going to put sustainment in there. You really are going to put mortuary affairs in there. You really are talking about CASAVAC and MEDEVAC so that the system and the individuals can see that. But I do think that's going to be a challenge. And we've had windows of time where we'll have a rule two with a forward resuscitative surgical detachment, and it'll give them 15, 20 patients, potentially 30. Well, in Lisko in Ukraine, they see 30 and then another 30 and then another 30 and they see another 30. They're evacuating 1,200 folks out of the battle space in a limited time per day. And they're doing up to 200 surgeries at a roll two surgical facility, right? So how do you do that to scale? You almost can't, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, think about the moral injury that goes along with now triaging people to immediate, delayed, expectant. That's a different conversation that we've not actually had and haven't had to have for a long time.
It's kind of scary. You got to fight through it. You can't just stop. Let's make our way back to triage.
Okay.
Is triage happening at the point of injury, or is it happening, or you're taking the patient from point of injury to the CCP or casualty collection point, or is it happening at the ambulance exchange point? How is triage working within that?
It's at point of injury, and then when you evac, you triage into the evac system, and you get to roll one, you're triaged again, and then when you moved, you're triaged again, and then when you get to roll two, you're triaged again, because the scenario changes. Your clinical status changes, the supply changes, air superiority changes, corridors open, and all of a sudden, you're able to now save those folks that you couldn't save 2 hours ago. Or you were able to evacuate, and now there's no air superiority anymore, and all those folks that were planning on moving from roll one to roll two can't, and now you triage differently. So you triage during the entire continuum. It's not a finite point, yes and no, and don't have to do it again.
Thanks for clarifying.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So it's really, it goes back to that definition, that I'm going to say MET-TCI. Mm-hmm. Every single MET-TCI needs to be assessed. Every single point.
And every single time, and yeah. It will change. So that's why when you start to train this, how do you make the environment inconsistent, more stressful, so that, you know, you had air superiority yesterday, you don't have it today. You have all the ground you need today, but you don't have it today. Tomorrow, you have all the supplies you need, and now tomorrow you don't have any of those. And then how do you do that at point of injury, casual collection point, ambulance exchange points, roll one, roll two, roll three?
Wow. Okay. Yeah. It's a big problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And we saw this in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, I was in Ramadi in 03 and 04, and we had 24 patients over about 18 hours. But because they were spread out over 18 hours, it was pretty easy to say, okay, you three, four casualties came in. We managed you, put you on the bird. Three or four more casualties came in. And we even triaged them to where they sit in an ambulance or where they sit in a helicopter. The most severely one is the last one on and the first one off, right? And then we had a 40-person mass cal where two convoy briefs were occurring and mortars landed between the two of them. All 40 came in at the exact same time. So then that triage conversation again occurred. Who gets chest tubes? Who needs fluids? Who needs to be on the first helicopter back to surgical support in downtown Baghdad? And then even that became complicated because we had forward resuscitative surgical detachments and the Roll 3 facility. Roll 3 had a neurosurgeon, the forward resuscitative surgical detachment did not. So we triaged the patient to go on the first bird that went to downtown Baghdad because they had a neurosurgeon. So even that complexity of triage is what you're doing at the role three, role two, role one, you're probably not doing that at point of injury, debating which facility has a neurosurgeon and how they go out. You're just trying to get them to that next level of care. It gets pretty complicated.
From both a doctrinal and a training lens, how can soldiers or leaders at any rank, any NMOS, increase their readiness to triage a large number of casualties? And we kind of danced around this.
Right? Yeah. So I think a couple things have to happen is A, you got to get the definition, which we're doing. And mm-hmm. then B, you've got to start putting the training platform out there. If you go back 30, 40 years, we actually used to teach triage. We used to teach CASAVAC. All of that was part of the muscle memory we were building. We didn't have to do that in Iraq and Afghanistan. Everyone got combat lifesavers. We had medics everywhere. And you had a medevac system that worked pretty much all the time. So now we've got to go back and build all of the muscle memory, all the doctrine, all the ATPs that are doing that. Even if you go back and read the TCCC, or Tactical Combat Casualty Care mm-hmm. Guidelines, there's almost a full sentence about triage. Almost, right? So it just tells you it hasn't even been part of the conversation since TCCC came to an existence. And that document is now being rewritten, and it's going to be two pages of triage. And then every emergency medicine trained certification of our whiskeys used to have nothing on triage. Well, that book published in January, it now has an entire chapter on triage, right? So now we're catching up in all the doctrines and all the way we teach that. And then now we have to layer it into our whiskey program, and then you have to get it back into AIT and basic across the system for us to sort of start from scratch. To include Bolick, I can't imagine we talk about, you know, CASAVAC and triage and Bolick. We probably do at Medco, but I bet we don't do it at all the other centers of excellence, is put that as a normal standard block. And have that conversation.
We talked about casualty evacuation. You've mentioned that a few times, so let's dive into that. So I think what's interesting is that from a doctrinal standpoint, there's two publications. One's medical evacuation, which is ATP 4-02.2, and there's an entire publication on casualty evacuation, which is ATP 4-02.13. I think there's some, even though we have two separate publications that probably do a really good job of defining that, I think there's a lot of folks who don't dig into those publications. So could you share with listeners some common misunderstandings or what they should understand between Medevac and CASAVAC?
Yeah, Medevac is where you really put in that nine line. And the system that comes and supports you is an ambulance with a Red Cross on it, a helicopter with a Red Cross on it. And what is expected inside that helicopter, inside that ambulance, is a clinically trained medic, PA, depends on where you are on the battlefield, a paramedic, with the equipment that can manage more complicated problem sets. And that's what we saw across Iraq and Afghanistan. You called in a nine line, you got a helicopter with a Red Cross right at the point of injury with eventually a paramedic in the back of that helicopter every time. That's not what CASAVAC is. CASAVAC is no Red Cross on a vehicle and no medic and no equipment dedicated to patient care in the back of that vehicle. It's the Humvee, it's the trailer, it's the donkey, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's whatever it takes to get that patient out of the battlefield. And it's not going to come with a medic. It's not going to come with all the supplies that you would expect to have in an ambulance, either in the air or on the ground. And it really is just a casualty, which just means someone's injured, versus medical, which is where they're injured, but now they're involved in the medical system of care.
Okay, yeah. So is this a good equation? Like Army health system and Medevac are linked, or
correct.
They are the same?
They're all the same. It's all part of that continuum of care from point of injury to an evac to role one to an evac to role two to evac. Mm-hmm. That's all Medevac, right? CASAVAC, truthfully, is point of injury. There is no medic around. How do you get them to medical care, whether it's the medic at the role one or the role two, and then you can move them from there.
So can you talk through that integration, or maybe it's what commanders are thinking about, how they're integrating that CASAVAC piece into the Medevac, into the Army health system?
So I think that brings up a really important point of how the medical community and the warfighting line community getting together and sort of talking about what does this look like when there isn't a medevac and a medic far forward? How are we putting that into our TTXs? How are we putting that into our training environment, into our FTXs? And what truly has to happen is there has to be an understanding of who's managing that point of injury. And it's like oftentimes going to be combat lifesavers, which is just the soldier being trained. They're going to move them through CASAVAC to a casualty collection point. And then at the casualty collection point is typically where the medical assets are pushed forward, pick them up, and then move them to further back. Or that casualty collection point has to move them back to an ambulance exchange point, an AXP. And then that's be the first location you actually see a medic dedicated with ground or air with a Red Cross on and moving it back. So the line community's responsibility and probably emphasis needs to be how do you plan for this? How do you TTX, FTX, and then train this, moving them back from point of injury, managing that care? How are you going to load up the vehicle? How do you get them to a casualty collection point? And if you can, how do you then move them to an ambulance exchange point? And then from there, they're into the healthcare system, and then we're managing all that care. That being stated, in large-scale combat operations, we're not going to have enough air or ground assets, so we may have to put you inside a role two and then lower your care a little bit while we put you back in a less traditional vehicle to move back and then put you back in the healthcare system. At that point, we likely will be moving you with medical assets and supplies, but you may not be moving with a vehicle with a Red Cross on it because there's just not going to be enough vehicles.
What should soldiers be weighing the risk of placing casualties on that CASAVAC platform? Because of there's no in-route care.
Yeah, so oftentimes in the Army, we talk about math and physics problems. In medicine, we talk about anatomy and physiology. And anatomy and physiology sort of dictate you how well that patient, how well that casualty is going to do. And if I need to get you to a surgeon within a certain amount of time, or you're going to lose a limb, or you're just not going to live, I may risk putting you on a casualty because you're going to be stable for about 25, 30, 40 minutes. But if you're not to a surgeon within that 40 minutes, then you're probably not going to do well. If on the other hand, I wait to move you, I missed the 40 minutes, and there's only so much you can do at point of injury with just some tourniquets and potentially some blood. Mm-hmm. So I think it's that time that goes along with anatomy and physiology is important from a CASAVAC standpoint. So you may risk in your mind not having a medic in the back, but probably that patient may be stable enough for the 30, 40 minute drive to then get to the level of care that actually can save their lives.
So even though we're the golden hour is not a thing, time still is really important.
It is, yeah. So truthfully, if you get hit in an artery, you're probably going to bleed out in 5 to 10 minutes. That's just an anatomy and a physiology problem, right? And if I put a tourniquet on that, now you're not going to bleed out. But if I don't get that tourniquet off in about 3 to 6 hours, you're going to lose that leg. Now, if I get that tourniquet off at 6 to 8 hours, when you release that tourniquet, all that dead muscle that's there, that actually gets moved to your body just because of the way anatomy and physiology. That now has potassium levels that are out of control. It has factors that actually can hurt your kidneys. And what we're seeing in the Ukraine is very similar to what we saw in the Vietnam War. The third most common cause of death is actually complications from prolonged care. Right. So every time you move something in that window of time, anatomy and physiology changes the problem set from you die in the first 10 minutes from just bleeding out. The first 3 to 6 hours, you lose a leg. After that, you're sort of in an ICU level setting where you really need high end care. And if I don't move you back to that high end care, when I let down that tourniquet for a true arterial bleed, you're still not going to survive because I don't have the right assets for to take care of you.
Okay. I think we kind of talked about this within the training and doctrine piece, but anything else about how the Army can get better at CASAVAC?
I think it's just practice. I think it's really put it at all the training environments, right? So it's got to be in the institutional domain. And then I think it's got to be in the operational domain for us to actually get there. And I think it's got to be put into a battle rhythm. So when I was a commander of more of an operational unit, when we would go to the range, that's when we did TCCC training. That's when we talked about triage. That's when we talked about moving patients in the back of a Humvee versus an ambulance. And just put it into the space of where else would you treat being shot other than at the range, mm-hmm. And putting all that part there. So how do we use the opportunities we have now to really emphasize where we can do this training to make it even more realistic? You know, if you're on the range, what's your biggest issue? Accident and discharge and getting shot. How do you start prepping everyone that's there for that?
That's great. Okay, so moving on to our last topic, sir. That's disease and non-battle injury, DNBI. So could you start by giving listeners some examples of DNBI and why this matters to the Let's Go Fight?
Yeah, we'll start at the non-battle injury because it's a little bit easier, right? So it truly, if you're lifting something too heavy and hurts your back, that's a non-battle injury, right?
Okay.
If you're, you know, moving something and your leg gets caught between the bumper and the trailer, right, and it fractures a bone, that's a non-battle injury. A non-battle injury such as, you know, lifting up something too heavy is nothing different than we do with H2F here, right? Or you go and you do PT and you pull your hamstring. You just need to get that rehab. You need to get to a physical therapist, an athletic trainer, to get you back into the fight faster. Disease gets a little bit more complicated, right? Because that talks about behavioral health. So promotes traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorders as part of disease. And then disease is also things like malaria and dengue, diarrhea, respiratory tract infections. And then it gets even more complicated, but let's not keep getting more complicated than that. So what we've seen historically from a disease non-battle injury, if you put in total what the battle injury, disease non-battle injury, sort of a pie chart, only about 15 to 20% of what we see on the battlefield is true battle injuries. That means 85% is really disease non-battle injury. And it depends on what theater you were in. In Iraq and Afghanistan, it was a very, very low threat for sort of tropical medicine diseases like malaria and dengue. Not that it was zero, but very, very low. But on the other hand, if you move to Africa, it's probably the highest risk in the world. Probably the next highest risk in the world is Southeast Asia and a little bit of South America. So, you know, one of our primary theaters is actually a very, very high risk for tropical diseases. As an example, dengue is an issue in sort of Southeast China right now. Measles is an issue in the Vietnam region right now. A crazy disease called melioidosis occurred in Taiwan after the typhoon earlier this year, right?
Oh.
Yeah, so we see this all the time, and now we're going to move to a space where sort of leishmaniasis and diarrhea and colds is about all we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan, to now we have all these different problems. And what you see is not only do they impact you, and if you go back to Vietnam War and World War II, the number of lost duty days from disease non-battle injury is truly substantial. But it's not just lost duty days. If you're injured and taken off the battlefield, the commander just needs you reconstituted, just needs a new person. If on the other hand, you hurt your back bad enough that you can't fight, but I'm not reconstituting you, I'm not bringing you, no one's replacing you. Now the number of people fighting has decreased. But even look at it differently, if you're really tired from having diarrhea all last night, or you just can't breathe because you're cold so bad, you're not going to run up that hill near as fast, mm-hmm. right? And you're probably not as accurate with your weapon system. So now that commander has to understand that disease non-battle injury of the non-evacuated patients are going to impact combat performance. And if they can't take the hill fast and they can't hit as accurate with their weapon system, now all of a sudden, from a logistical standpoint, they need more ammo. They need more food. They need more vehicles.
Wow.
They need more gas because my performance is not 90 to 100%. And I can still run up the hill, right? I can still squeeze the trigger, mm-hmm. but I'm doing it 50 to 60% time as accurate. And cumulatively, in large-scale combat operations, when you start losing people, every person becomes more important, and every person being fully functional at their best performance becomes more important. And that's where disease non-battle injury can really hurt you. Is the commander's not losing a person. They're just losing a capacity as much as they are a capability. And that's why DNBI can have a huge impact on the battlefield, especially as we think about Indo-PACOM and how many problem sets are going to show us.
So what can commanders and just leaders in general think about reducing DNBI?
Yeah. So the non-battle injury is sort of pretty good because we have this H2F system that everyone's treating on, right?
Yeah.
So how do you lift better? How do you run faster? How do you get a better score on the ACFT? I'm going to argue, how do we do H2F in the battle space better, right? So as you look at the future battlefield, you know, we've had 14-day evacuations in Iraq and Afghanistan. In World War II, they had 60 and 120 days evacuated. So they basically rehabbed everyone in theater if they could. So if someone hurts their back bad enough, they can't lift anything, can you just pull them back, get them with a physical therapist, rehab in theater, and then push them back forward? And potentially, how do you put a physical therapist or an athletic trainer equivalent far forward? Because are we really teaching them how to lift that ammo? Are we really teaching them how to load that vehicle? Are we really teaching them how to run with their ruck? We don't do that in H2F, but we will have to do that in the combat environment. So can you not only buy down the risk by training far forward what to be doing in that different environment, but number two, how can we rehab in theater versus bring you all the way back? So the lessons that we're seeing with H2F and how we employ H2F in garrison, if you twist it 10, 15, 20%, it's probably exactly what we should be doing downrange also, right? And then when you look at disease, we'll start at behavioral health problem sets. I think we've all seen the struggles we're having with behavioral health support. Just like there's not enough behavioral health support in garrison and we've gone to MFLEX or, you know, family community support, we need to figure out how to give more support forward versus it being a psychiatrist or a psychologist. You know, how does that chaplain, how does that best buddy be able to help you from that disease behavioral health problem set? And I think that's where we're going to have to really talk about resiliency. I think we're going to have to really talk about moral injury and what that means in a casualty environment and the environment that we're seeing. As an example, it's so stressful in Ukraine right now that everyone gets a two-day course on behavioral health resiliency from the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. It's an exportable course that every Ukraine soldier gets because the stress associated with drones is unimaginable, right? You hear a buzz, and next thing you know is someone dropping ammunition on you, or is a firing sequence bringing something to hit you in the next 4 to 6 minutes. That's a big issue from a behavioral health standpoint. And actually, it's gone back to almost World War I with the trench warfare, is they'll put them on the line for a week and then take them off the line for 2 weeks, and then put them back on the line for a week and take them off, just like we had to do in World War I. Think about that in the environment in the Ukraine. And I think you can have the same conversations in INDOPACOM with the battles, the island hopping, with just sort of the oppressive heat and the humidity in that part of the environment. And then you add drones and all that kind of information. So that's sort of the H2F approach. That's sort of the behavioral health resiliency. How do we enhance our medics? How do we enhance each other in being better at being more resilient and individually not having behavioral health issues, but having our support structure around us to get us through them when we do? And then it's the disease, sort of as you alluded to. How do we make sure we now do preventive medicine, personal protective measures, public health? So clean water, wash your hands before you eat, make sure your latrines are in the right location, don't put them near everyone else. If you're on malaria medicines, make sure you take it. If there's mosquitoes everywhere, put your insect repellent on, wear your uniform appropriately. I appreciate it could be, you know, crazy humid, crazy hot, but malaria is really bad. Dinghy is really bad. Mm-hmm. Let's put up a little bit of heat to not get those other diseases. And I think that's where the commanders just start to have to force that back in that training environment. You know, we talk about why can't you have your t-shirt? People say sunburn. Well, actually, no. I should be able to teach you to have a uniform that already is impregnated with DEET so you don't get bitten by mosquitoes. Just make it muscle memory that you just wear it all the time. I don't care how hot it is, because it's protected you from the mosquito. It's not necessarily protecting you from the sun, although it's doing that too.
Going back to that Walter Reed course, mm-hmm. the Ukraine Armed Forces seen positive impacts from that, or is it still too early?
Too early. They are just now rolling out their registries. Sort of, it took us about 5 years to roll out our registry. It's taking them about 2 years to roll out their registry, so they're able to capture data, be able to analyze that data, and then talk about interventions afterwards. they know they need something. So this was sort of the starting point. And that it's a pretty good course. It's been validated to actually have an impact. And to the point we're looking at putting it into our training for our combat medics also, to see if we can have them have some enhanced behavioral health training also.
Okay. And then, so you talk, that's one of the initiatives that you're doing at Medco for DNBI. Any other initiatives that you're rolling out for the medical community or for the Army at large?
I think there's a lot out there already that's really good. But as we talked about with battle injuries and triage and CASAVAC, we just didn't need to do that. I think it's the same thing. We didn't have to put this huge emphasis on disease, non-battle injury in Iraq and Afghanistan, because if you had a bad back, we just evacuated back to Larmsey and Landstuhl in Germany or back to the States and no one cared, right? If you got a cold or diarrhea, we just either canceled the op or just said, we didn't need that many extra people. So I think we just need to go back to the basics. You know, we talk about being brilliant in the basics. I think we just need to be brilliant in the basics. And if we just go back to where we are, it was really good. I mean, if you're old enough, this is the training we actually did. You know, I've been in the Army since 92, so a bit. We used to do this training when I went to Pollock. How do we get back to, you know, where do you dig the ditch when you have to go to the bathroom? I mean, not even a conversation in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
You got to figure out, I mean, who even takes that shovel with them anymore when they deployed?
Think I didn't.
Right. I'm going to tell you, you need that shovel. One, you better have that shovel to dig out some dirt for other reasons. But you may need that shovel for a place to go to the bathroom, too. So I think we just got to go back to being brilliant in the basics. That being stated, we appreciate that learning methods and the teaching methods of 1992, when there was no cell phone, there was no PowerPoint, is a little bit different, right? So how do we make sure that we have a modern approach to teaching that people actually can absorb? So how do we put that into podcasts like this, or how do we put this into, you know, a TikTok equivalent or a real equivalent approach to being able to answer these gaps in a way the current youth... Imagine Generation A is about 4 or 5 years away from being our formations, right? And I heard this week that Generation B will be born about 2025, and they will be called the artificial intelligence generation, right? So how do we make sure we're moving into this space? And I think that's what we struggle with. We are updating our trauma courses, like our tactical combat medical course, our brigade combat trauma training course. Many of you in our field hospital that brings in these more modern LISCO MDO concepts versus sort of a coin fight of the last 20 years.
Okay. Any other parting thoughts, sir, before we wrap up the episode?
So a few things to consider. Our CASAVAC is going to change to an FM series.
Okay.
And it's going to transition to a FM3 series, actually. And it's going to change to a 308. So from a 4 series to a 3 series is always impressive. And then 08 is the SRC for all medical units of 08. So that's the reason it went to that. So CASAVAC's being rewritten right now. It's on a shortened cycle of a year. Hospitalization is being rewritten right now. Army Health Plan 402 is being rewritten right now. We hope all of those will come out September, October of this year. I think what we've highlighted is that this is really going to impact the warfighters, is really going to impact our ability to carry out missions if we aren't able to lean into this. And the problem sets are going to be really different in the future battle. When you're talking about, you know, 1,000 casualties a day, and you talk about disease non-battle injury rates that we're going to see, especially in the Indo-PACOM fight, it's going to change combat performance, and that's going to impact the commanders. And I think we got to start layering that in to sort of everything we do.
Thanks, sir, so much for coming on the podcast. I know I learned a lot today, and I hope our listeners did too.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. It's great. It's always great to be the first time we talk about medicine, I think, on the podcast.
Just like writing new doctrine is a team effort, breaking doctrine takes a team. Without the crew and special doctrine division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you this show. Please don't forget to subscribe on YouTube, Apple, Audible, or Spotify podcasts. And follow us on social media at U.S. Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, or the Combined Arms Center. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.